morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black Arts and Culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. We're going to be talking this morning about a movement that was organized in 2012 after Trayvon Martin's murder, Black Lives, hashtag Black Lives Matter. And I just want to read a little bit from the website, blacklivesmatter.com. And then we're going to talk to our guest, Nell Mihan, who is an Oakland-based organizer, author, and speaker whose work brings people together across age, race, class, and other differences, forming alliances to create powerful, effective solutions to common problems that leave no one out and no one behind. She is writing children's books that highlight solidarity and collective action for social justice towards creating the other world we know is possible. And perhaps why don't we just do it this way? I'm going to read a little bit about from the website. But before that, welcome, Nell, to the show. I'm glad you're joining us.
Thank you so much, Wanda. I appreciate you having me on.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the movement, All Black Lives Matter, and how you came to participate in it, specifically around the case of Marissa Alexander, who people might not remember because, you know, she was in the headlines, you know, around the time Trayvon Martin was killed, and then sort of her case kind of ebbs and flows depending on what corporate media deems newsworthy.
Right. So Marissa Alexander is a Black woman in Jacksonville, Florida, who fired a warning shot to prevent Rico Gray, her husband at the time, from carrying out his threat to kill her. There was a long history of domestic violence. She had been hospitalized in 2009 following a beating by him. She fired a warning shot and successfully defended herself, basically, against him. He called the police, and the police arrived as a SWAT team. They arrested Marissa. She was charged then with 3 counts of aggravated assault. And Special Prosecutor Angela Corey has been carrying out a vendetta against Marissa since then. We all know that self-defense is a right. It's not a crime. But Marissa Alexander, a Black woman, was charged with 3 counts of aggravated assault. She was convicted by a jury in 12 minutes of those 3 counts. In Florida, there's a mandatory minimum of 20 years. So she received 3 20-year sentences that were to be served concurrently. The case was so egregious that on appeal, the conviction was actually overturned. The jury had received improper instructions, you know, really by any reasonable person's standard. Marissa never should have been charged. On appeal, the conviction was overturned. And rather than Angela Corey accept that she was had carried out an improper indictment and prosecution, she decided to continue her vendetta against Ms. Alexander, indict her again, and put her back through a trial. Marissa is the mother of 3 children. She had a 9-day-old infant when she was arrested. You can imagine what it has done to her and to her family, her children. To have this traumatic experience at the hands of the state. So recently she accepted a plea deal, and so she's back in jail. The agreement is that she will be in jail until January 27th, at which time she's expecting to be released on probation with an ankle monitor for 2 years. And we think that's really improper, incorrect, unjust, and unacceptable, because Marissa Alexander had a right to defend herself. She did not harm anybody. She fired a warning shot. No one was injured. And so why should she be facing any jail time? So we're fighting to get her out, and we're having a teach-in on Sunday, December 14th, from 1 to 4 p.m. at the Berkeley Public Library to raise public awareness, but more importantly, to organize some direct actions, because we want to put pressure on the system. You know, we see these national uprisings in reaction to the murders of black people across the country. Every 28 hours, a black man, woman, or child is murdered by the police, a security guard, or a vigilante. Every 28 hours. And that is a horrific reality that we're dealing with, that's compounded by the fact that the secret grand juries, in the case of Eric Garner and Michael Brown, the two most recent examples that we have, failed to indict the officers who had murdered them. And so we've seen these uprising across the country. And so we're going to be organizing some direct action in defense of Marissa Alexander's life.
Yeah, you actually were one of the lead organizers in a recent Black People sit-in December 6th last week at 11 a.m. at the Rockridge BART station. And I just wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, as well as just the whole idea of, you know, Black Lives Matter, which is not a moment but a movement that seeks to expand what it says on the website, the narrow nationalism that can be prevailing within black communities, which merely call on black people to love black people, live black and by black, keeping straight black men in the front of the movement, while black women, queer folks, trans and disabled folk take up roles in the background and not at all. On the website, it says that Black Lives Matter affirms the lives of black queer and trans folks, disabled folks, black undocumented folks, folks with records, women, and all black lives along the gender spectrum. It centers those that have been marginalized within black liberation movements. It is a tactic to build the black liberation movement.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, and I believe we have some guests calling in to talk as well about this topic. So why don't you answer the question about, you know, the organizing that you've already been a part of, like last
mm-hmm.
week.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah.
So you give me a little too much credit when you say I was a lead organizer. I was one of the people who showed up and answered to the call that came out.
Okay.
And I was proud to be a part of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was proud to be a part of that. Actually, I got involved in the run up to Black Friday, when Black Lives Matter and the Onyx Organizing Committee, Alan Blue for Center for Justice, the Blackout Collective, and some other individuals and organizations decided that we were going to interrupt business as usual on Black Friday by blockading the BART train. And so we had a couple of weeks that we took to get prepared to do that, and it was an amazing coming together of black folks, right, acting in defense of our own lives. Intentionally, consciously, and strategically. So we were able to hold the BART train for a couple of hours. The BART station was actually closed for the 4 hours and 28 minutes that was our goal. And we chose that number based on two things. One thing is that for 4.5 hours, Michael Brown's body lay in the street in Ferguson after Darren Wilson had murdered him in cold blood. And we see that as a form of terrorism, that the police are shooting us down in the street, and then they're disregarding any respect. There's no respect for black lives in the minds of the state and of the police. And so we are expressing a strong objection to that and an unwillingness to accept that as terms of engagement here in the United States. So 4.5 hours was part of what we, you know, our goal was to, you know, shut down the BART for that period of time. The 28 minutes part comes in because we know that every 28 hours, a black man, woman, or child somewhere in the United States is murdered at the hands of the police, a security guard, or a vigilante. Every 28 hours. That's basically every day. And once again, Black Lives Matter. And we refuse to accept that that is how things are going to run here. We're going to be interrupting business as usual until we get justice, until the murders of black people stop, and that the police who have murdered black people are held accountable. Darren Wilson was not indicted by a secret grand jury. Daniel Pantaleo in Staten Island, New York, who choked Eric Garner to death on the street on camera, was not indicted. That is an outrage. We refuse to continue to accept that. So, so we blocked the BART train on Black Friday, and the most recent action that you referred to is that we went to one of the upscale neighborhoods in the San Francisco Bay Area on Saturday. A group of about, I think there were maybe like 60 of us, and went into a series of restaurants, shopping centers, grocery stores, places where people are, you know, are doing business, and interrupted business as usual in those places. We entered and made a statement that Black Lives Matter, that we are protesting the blatant murders of black people at the hands of the at the hands of the state, and the refusal of the state to do anything about that. We read the names of 25 victims of state violence, their ages, and then left singing, "Which Side Are You On, My Friend? Which Side Are You On?" As a way of raising awareness and, you know, changing the temperature. I mean, you know, it's like we're living in a time when black lives are being just snuffed out like candles. And there's a kind of insensitivity. I mean, I'm being kind, right? There's an insensitivity to that. And we are determined that that is going to change. We are going to change the temperature here in the United States until it gets hot for everybody, and everybody is pulling at their collar and sweating and trying to figure out, well, what can we do about this? Because I'm uncomfortable now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what about the action on Monday on I-80? Where the freeway was blocked for several hours.
Right. So we have seen uprising across the country. I think it has really captured the attention of a larger segment of the nation, because it's just coming, so quickly, and the cases are so egregious. You know, we are living here in the Bay Area, where Oscar Grant was assassinated on the Fruitvale BART platform by Johannes Meserle in 2009, January 1st, 2009. He was lying on his belly on the BART platform and was shot dead in the back by Johannes Meserle. Johannes Meserle was indicted. He did face trial. He was convicted, and I think he spent a year in jail. Black Lives Matter, and we do not accept that that was a reasonable consequence for his action. We're living here in the Bay Area, where Alan Bluford was murdered by the police. That officer, Masso, was not indicted, right? So we have been we have a body count that is just sickeningly long And there's been organizing, and we have, you know, been raising the issue and changing the climate and raising the issue and changing the climate. And so the most recent cases of Eric Garner and Michael Brown has really, you know, kind of pushed things to the point where across the country people have been reacting. The young people in Ferguson, they have been holding it down since August when Michael Brown was murdered, and then with the failure to indict Darren Wilson, it really, you know, called all of us into more action. So here in the Bay Area, there have been protests in Oakland and in Berkeley on multiple nights since the failure to indict Darren Wilson. The most recent ones have been the last four nights in Berkeley, where crowds of people have, peaceful protesters, have been attacked by the police, and those crowds have grown until the point that night before last, actually, there were about 1,500 people who blocked the I-80 freeway, which is the main thoroughfare, you know, that takes you across the country. So it's a very important transportation route. And also there were some folks who lay down on the Amtrak train track in front of an Amtrak train and risked their lives to stop that business as usual from happening, to raise awareness that Black Lives Matter and that they were willing to put their lives on the line to make the point that, you know, that that it's unacceptable to continue to murder Black people with, for the police to murder Black people with impunity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's see who's joining us, see if they want to add to the conversation. Good morning. Welcome to the show. Tell us who you are
good
and
morning.
If you have something to add to the conversation.
Goodness. Yes, good morning. This is Zan Joy. Good morning. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I just had a question for Nell about Marissa, and I understand that she has been put back in jail, and I'm wondering if you could talk more about that and explain what's happening there.
Right. Right. So Marissa Alexander was facing a new trial, and again, Special Prosecutor Angela Corey took the sinister tact of asking that if convicted, Marissa serve 3 20-year sentences consecutively, which would mean for Marissa Alexander, 33, that she would be in prison for life. For firing, let me just remind your listeners, for firing a single warning shot that hurt no one, she would be facing a life sentence. She would be 93 years old when she got out of jail. So what kind of choice is that, right? To risk that you would be prosecuted and receive possibly a life sentence for firing, for defending yourself, versus the plea deal, which she was offered, which... And accepted that put her back in jail, presumably with the agreement that she would be released on January 27th on 2 years of house arrest, essentially, with an ankle monitor that she would have to pay for and would constrict her movement. We know that many, many people, the vast majority of people who are in jail are there for violation of probation, so it's a kind of trap, and so we're fighting to get Marissa out of jail and pardoned and have all those charges removed, have her exonerated, because she never should have been prosecuted in the first place. The case against her is that she's Black and female and had the temerity to defend her own life against the batterer. that really is what, you know, she was guilty of, and that's why she's serving time.
Absolutely.
So we're having a teach-in. Yeah, so we're having a teach-in on and direct action planning on December 14th at the Berkeley Public Library to raise awareness and to do some direct action planning so that we can defend her life against this assault that is happening to her at the hands of the state. We are inviting people to join us at that teach-in and direct action planning between 1 and 4. The Berkeley Public Library is at 2090 Kittredge Street in Berkeley. It's just a few blocks from the downtown Berkeley BART station.
Great. I will be there. Thank
Great.
You so much.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for joining us. Okay, we have another person joining us. Good morning. Tell us who you are and what you want to add to the discussion. Hello? Maybe this person is just listening because they're not speaking. Okay. I wanted to ask you, Nell, on redirect. I wanted to ask you about the movement Black Lives Matter. Black lives have always mattered. And it just seems that all of a sudden the whole idea of, you know, state-sanctioned violence in the form of you know, the domestic military force, which is the police, has sort of come to a head, you know, with just the callous disregard for human life, Black lives specifically. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the trauma and about the Ma'afa and the recognition within the movement about the residual psychological effects of enslavement and how that is, undermining, let's say, our liberation as a people, because Black people also kill Black people.
So, I want to say that we are clear that Black lives matter. Since 1619, we have lived in this country under a racist system that values us only for what we can contribute to the wealth of the ruling Christian elite. And that's systematic, right? It's not coincidental. It's institutionalized, not happenstance. It's pervasive, and it's routine. So each generation of folks born here get conditioned to accept those terms that that white is superior, that white is the norm. It's not just about race. It's also about gender. It's also about class. It's about physical ability, right? We have, this system that says there's the normal person, the white, male, able-bodied, heterosexual, rich person, and then there's the other, and anybody who's not that becomes an other in the society. And the norm, the person who fits the norm, in quotes, is elevated, they have access, they're welcomed, they're recognized, their humanity is valued, they have credibility, and those of us who are othered are targeted for mistreatment, we're exploited, we experience violence. So we have a very long history of that experience here in the United States that has impacted us on many, many levels. And so part of what I hear you asking about is internalized racism, like how have we internalized white supremacy and male supremacy, patriarchy, and heterosexual normativity, right? How have we internalized those concepts? And then it plays out among us. And we are dealing with that reality. We are dealing with the reality that black people have internalized the stereotypes, the lies, and the misinformation used to justify our mistreatment. And it does play itself out in our families, right, in our communities, and even, you know, inside of our individual selves. But I see that as a symptom of a problem that is of the root problem, which is a system that values profit over people. That system of capitalism requires that we be conditioned to accept the systematic, institutionalized, pervasive, and routine mistreatment of individuals and groups, so that the very small minority of people here can benefit disproportionate to their numbers and to any effort that they make. We know that part of the legacy of slavery is a lot of unearned privilege, benefit, material resource that has been accumulated by white folks who held slaves and established laws and policies to protect their wealth. We continue to, those systems are still in place. I mean, we certainly have made some progress. I'm not going to try to argue that our situation is the same situation that Harriet Tubman faced, right? But the reality is that we are still living in a system that has racial bias, has a gender bias, that's institutionalized. It's in the policies. It's in the laws, as well as in the traditions. And that's what we're facing. And so to the degree that we play out our internalized racism against each other, then we advance the cause of white supremacy. And so that's part of why Black Lives Matter is such an important movement, because it's a movement that's built on black love plus black power. And it says that part of one of the things that we often say is we take Assata Shakur's words, it is our duty to fight for our freedom. It is our duty to win. We must love and protect each other. We have nothing to lose but our chains. I think I'm missing one of the lines, and so if someone can call in and say the rest of that. But it basically says that, you know, we must love and protect each other, and that we must use our power to break the chains that are around our feet, our necks, and our minds, to get out from under this system that wants to exploit us and kill us and use us just as grist for the mill.
Mm-hmm. as you were speaking, I was thinking about Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, who is well known for her book, The ISIS Papers. And she speaks in that book about the disease of white supremacy or racism. And, it's a virus. She speaks of it as a viral infection that is not only in the West, it actually has spread, you know, throughout the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you know, there are a lot of different strategies, to counter and immunize oneself against this viral infection that permeates everything, the media, the curriculum in the public school system. It's just one has to continually stay vigilant. And I was wondering, sort of in closing, if you could talk about, because with regards to this movement, Black Lives Matter, it's multiple tiered, and the healers are certainly present, within the gatherings. I was out of town when the Black Friday action happened in Oakland. But my editor, San Francisco Bayview, was telling me that, you know, she was just so excited over how beautiful it was that outside of the bar station down on the first level, there were various rituals being performed as the actions were taking place, you know, on the platform. Why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I want to just start by appreciating Patrice Cullors, Opal Tometi, and Alicia Garza, who are the co-creators of the Black Lives Matter moment that has become a movement. I just want to, you know, say their names because it's too frequent that the sound bites are remembered, and the energy and the effort, you know, of the folks who, you know, create the sound bites is lost. So I just want to appreciate them and say that that blockade was an amazing experience for me as a Black woman. It was, you know, we're living with such high levels of violence over such a long period of time that it's, you know, we could feel demoralized and discouraged and isolated from each other. And so this Black coming together, Black people intentionally, consciously, and strategically working together was really, really critical. And so there was the blockade that was happening on the BART platforms. We stopped both the Dublin Pleasanton train as well as the Daly City train. And in the community, there had been a healing circle that started earlier in the day that where there were Yoruba spiritual tradition and Haitian spiritual tradition and other African, spirituality had been happening so that people could come together to grieve and to mourn and to prepare, right, for the next steps in terms of creating some action to address this situation that we're in. So those folks came to the BART station and as part of the, and, you know, as part of the action that was all planned, that we were having a healing circle as part of the action. And that healing circle was very important in the community because the blockade was not a public, it wasn't a publicized action, but the healing circle was. And so it gave people, members of the community, the opportunity to gather and deal with that very important work of healing ourselves and preparing for to take action, you know, using grief into rage, rage into action. So when that group arrived, we could hear them. We could hear the drumming. We could hear the singing. We could hear the chanting. And so we were strengthened on the platform, and they could hear us. So they were strengthened on the ground. And the people in the community could hear all of it. And so there were people who had not known about either action, right, who came out because they could hear the drumming and they could hear the chanting. And they were enlivened, right? There was so much excitement to know that there was action being taken in defense of our lives. It was, that was for me a highlight because it's been very discouraging to get such just to have the violence be at such a high level and to have the response of the powers that be reinforce the violence basically. And so it has a way of isolating us, and we continue to be wounded past, you know, the initial incidents. And so this coming together meant that we could look into each other's faces and say, we, you know, Black people are important. Our lives do matter. Black love is an important piece of it, and Black power is another important piece of it, and we're putting those two things together and taking action in defense of our lives. So the cultural work, the spiritual work, and the direct action came together in a way that was very, very powerful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's excellent. That's excellent. Is there a way for people to stay in touch with you to find out about actions here in San Francisco Bay Area around Marissa Alexander's case?
Absolutely. So we'll have the teach-in on Sunday, December 14th at the Berkeley Public Library from 1 to 4, 2090 Kittredge Street in Berkeley. People can contact us at freemarissaeastbay@gmail.com. Free Marissa, M-A-R-I-S-S-A, eastbay@gmail.com. And they can call me at 510-543-5280.
Okay, excellent. And there's a website, freemarissanow.org, for people who want
that's
to find
right.
out more about her case. And
yes, that's
how you
right.
can also help. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the hearing is scheduled for January 27th. We have a fundraiser that we're planning for December 28th because she still has a tremendous amount of legal fees that she's dealing with. And we are also planning a caravan from the Bay Area across the country with stops along the way to raise awareness, raise funds, and bring some more people to the hearing. Again, we need to put pressure on the political system, on the justice system, and let them know that Black Lives Matter and that we will be showing up and disrupting business as usual until we get justice.
Yeah, yeah, there's California incarcerates more women than any other state in some countries. And then with the closure of one of the prisons in Central Valley, the women, I mean, they were already crowded, and the conditions are even more horrendous. And
right.
women are being, placed in newly opened privatized prisons, which have no jurisdiction. The state mm-hmm. doesn't have any mm-hmm. jurisdiction mm-hmm. over them. They do what they like. And then
right.
women are also placed in county facilities. So it's, it's really, really horrendous. And one of the lives that matter, because they are clearly delineated on the website in Black Lives Matter, that, we can't forget, folks that are incarcerated. We can't forget that silent population that,
right.
is so much a part of, who we are as a people, because that's a continuation of the slave plantation. So, yeah, so that's really wonderful that you're mobilizing around Marissa Alexander and keeping her name, in the forefront as you are, because she represents not just herself, but, millions of women who are locked up,
right.
millions of mothers.
Right.
And you just think about her children, goodness gracious, that her children are really young. And their mother
right.
has not been with them.
Yes. So we're fighting
yeah.
for her freedom. And like you said, she's a symbol. We have seen such powerful leadership coming out of the prisons. The hunger strike that took place last year and again and previous to that, I think 2010, was a very, very important act of leadership on the part of prisoners who are under the most, extreme pressure, right? But they figured out a way to communicate with each other and to find the common ground across racial lines and to put pressure on the system for better treatment inside the prisons. And so I really appreciate you bringing that up, because it's very important that we not be separated, because it's a continuum, right? We're here and they're shooting us down in the street, but we have millions of Black people locked behind bars for nothing, no reason at all, except that it's profitable and they want to put down any dissent, any opposition to their plans to dominate the environment, the people of various, countries, communities, states, nations, any resistance to that, they want to put that down. And so we have seen this, massive increase in incarceration. And, it's very important that we stay connected to people on the inside, because I am them and they are me.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. As they say in not certain which country in the Caribbean, but I is we.
mm-hmm.
And then the organization that was started by some folks here and elsewhere, All of Us or None, you know, uh-huh. none of us are free, uh-huh. and all of us
yeah.
are free.
Yeah.
And you know, to one of the founders, Ronald Elder Freeman just made his transition, and his brother,
mm-hmm.
Ronald Freeman,
mm-hmm.
just made his transition. They're founders of the Black Panther Party in Southern California.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you know, sort of had their home going, you know. But that's really a real key call, you know, all of us or none.
Yeah.
But I wanted to mention,
yeah.
I was looking on the website before you go, and I wanted to ask you about this, that there is a Black Lives Matter conference January 15th through 17th, and then I also saw that there's these rides across the country. So I wonder if you could talk about those two, like the rides, because you mentioned caravanning across the country from California to Florida to support Marissa Alexander, and when she goes before the judge again. And I was just wondering if you could talk about these other rides, if you know of them, and in this conference specifically, January 15th to 17th in 2015.
So, as I said, I'm pretty new to the Black Lives. I'm not one of the main organizers, and so I'm not the best qualified person to talk about that.
Okay.
I do know that there were some rides that, you know, went across the country, and that was to garner support and help people, you know, organize in various places, and quite effective. There are Black Lives Matters folks in many communities across the country who are, you know, we've seen that become a meme, as they say. And I don't know about the January 15th Black Lives Matter conference. So
Well, the conference is at the University of Arizona.
Okay.
And you can look up HTTP /BLM for Black Lives Matter .sbs.arizona.edu.
Great.
And you can
Fantastic.
Get information about the conference. It's being hosted by the Gender and Women's Studies Department at University of Arizona. And it says scholars, writers, artists, activists, policymakers, and community members will come together in Tucson, Arizona in January to discuss why Black Life Matters and what can be done about sustained radicalized state violence. And they have a Facebook page.
Mm-hmm.
So
great,
looks
Fantastic.
Good. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Indeed.
Well,
so, again, I appreciate you having us on.
Oh yeah, I'm so happy to have you on, and look forward to continued conversations. And I hope that the teaching goes well on Sunday. I'm going to be traveling, so I won't be able to come to that. But we've had. People on talking about Marissa Alexander's case, you know, numerous times over the past couple of years. So definitely want to keep her name lifted and keep people focused on that this woman is not free. When we last spoke, she was on, like, minimum security house arrest, kind of. But now
right.
she's back in prison. So which
right.
means who's taking care of her children?
Right.
Yeah. So anyway, it was great talking to you, Nell, and look forward to and thanks for letting me know about the work that you're participating in, because you sent me the information.
You're very welcome, Wanda. And I want to just send condolences to the Freeman family, and much appreciation and gratitude for the work, the, you know, vision, the risks, the, you know, on the ground, you know, and visionary, important work, you know, done by the Black Panther Party for self-defense, you know, that those are our political ancestors, right? And, you know, we honor and praise them, because that you know, I often talk about in 1970 when J. Edgar Hoover cited the Black Panther Party breakfast program as the greatest threat to national security in the country. which really pointed to the power of the party. I mean, it was, you know, there were a lot of powerful things they were doing. And one of them was this very, very loving intended thing of feeding the children. So I just have a lot of gratitude for that vision and that work, you know, that really laid the foundation for the work that we're doing today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then you think about, you know, the same J. Edgar Hoover who, you know, who fine-tuned his or started his, you know, work around trying to undermine and extinguish black liberation movements with the Honorable Marcus Mosiah Garvey 100 years ago this past July, you know, with the UNIAACL, the Universal Negro Improvement Association, African Communities League, you know, this brother who, you know, said race first and was organizing, you know, Africans throughout the diaspora, you know, with newspapers and, you know, independent black businesses and just teach people to be, you know, proud of their ancestry and showing how we're all connected and that, yes, you know, black lives matter. They mattered then, they continue to matter. And the state repression is still happening 100 years later. It was happening before Garvey. And it continues. Yeah. It's like, oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So we have to know that, you know, that, and we're still here, right?
Yes, we are.
So, you know, but, you know, there has not ever been a day that we have not been in resistance against it. And there will never be a day until it's over that we're not in resistance, you know. So, action, direct action in defense of the lives of black people, Black Lives Matter.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you again,
Martha.
Take
good care. Oh, you're welcome.
Thank
Peace and blessings.
Thank you so much. Peace and blessings.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
Bye-bye.
So we're going to play a piece, Prayer for a Continent African Tapestry by Baba Tunde Lee.
Barasuwayo! Thank you.
that was Babatunde Lee's Prayer for a Continent, African Tapestry, Prayer for a Continent, that is the CD it comes from. We're going to close with something from the archives. Aisha Brown, out of Supervisor Keith Carson's office, speaking about African-American organizations making a connection this past February 24th with the interview 2013. Peace and blessings. I want to thank you, Aisha, for joining us this morning to talk about the second African-Americans Making Connections. Really enjoyed, I didn't realize it had been 3 years ago, really enjoyed the first one, and really looking forward to seeing people again and making some new connections, as well as sort of retying some knots and retying some links that maybe might have grown a little slack over the 3 years since, you know, we first decided to sort of, you know, start doing some work together, particularly around, I'm really interested in juvenile justice. Mm-hmm. And met some really cool people, like a judge and the person who's like over the young people at the juvenile prison, the newest one over on 150th. Uh-huh. Yeah, so anyway, looking forward to seeing those folks again and seeing how we can maybe keep our young people from going into those systems in the first place. And with your background in clinical psych, I'm sure, and also your work in early childhood education, I'm sure you've been really strategic and crucial with regards to getting certain people to these forums and to the table so that they can make connections with other people. So maybe we'll start with that, sort of your role in this big event, second one that we've had in 3 years, and then we'll go back and I'll share your extensive biographical preparation with our audience.
Sure, sure. Thank you, Wanda, first of all, for having our office and allowing me the opportunity to speak today with your audience and your listeners about the second African-American Organizations Making Connections event at Laney College. So we did this in 2010, and really the first attempt was really to just bring people together to learn about what was happening and have some conversations and build collaboration and relationships.
Mm-hmm.
But this opportunity, we wanted to build upon that. Okay, so now we got together, we know who we are. Now let's really think about what can we do. You know, we have some time to network, and that's great and all, but now we've got to roll up our sleeves. Things haven't changed. Actually, things have gotten worse. You know, our crime, and our, especially in the urban areas, in Oakland and, you know, in Richmond, you know, crime is going up and people are kind of feeling hopeless, and we need to figure out how we as black people come together to make some change. We can't wait for someone to come in and save us. We really got to work together and leverage our resources and build upon that. And we're doing some great work amongst each other in all these different areas. We're doing great work in juvenile justice. We're doing great work in early education, mm-hmm. and in the arts, and, you know, and so we need to just figure out what strategies can we put together to help people learn how to build businesses. You know, oftentimes we come from great innovative history of people being, you know, entrepreneurs, and we need to think about how do we do that? How do we show people how to build businesses? How do we get people to talk about better communication, the basic thing, basic fundamental? How do we better communicate with our younger generation to let them know, you know, this is not acceptable with what's happening, working together? And then dialogue between men and women. And that there are so many conversations that we need to have. We thought when we're putting this event together, how do we do that? How do we bring in a good complement of people to have those conversations? So we have people from all across different gamuts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Why don't you tell us about, you have like plenaries and then you have breakout sessions. It's an all-day event. It's like you mentioned, it's at Laney College, which is located at 900 Fallon Street in Oakland near the Lake Meadow BART. It actually is across the street. But from 8:30 to 3, so it's a, you know, people are asked to devote a, you know, a big portion of their Saturday to this idea of making organizational connections, because, you know, we have Kwame Ture talked about how, you know, we are successful as we are able to organize, because when you organize, it means that you can repeat successes as opposed
right.
to a one-time
right.
good thing.
Mm-hmm. Right. So in the opening session, the opening plenary is really, we have Congresswoman Barbara Lee. We have former Black Panther leaders, Bobby Seale mm-hmm. and Elaine Brown. And then we have new social justice and environmental justice leader Jakarta Imani from Ella Baker Center coming together, moderated by Greg Hodge,
mm-hmm.
to come together to talk about where we've been. So we, you know, talking about the successes of the Black Panther Party, the successes of our civil rights movement. And then we have a congresswoman coming, giving her lens and talking about the work that she's doing in D.C. on the more local and global and national levels. And then we have Jakarta talking about his grassroots efforts today and what's happening right now. And how do we use the best practices of what happened previously that went really well
mm-hmm.
and bring that forward? So that conversation starts at 9:30, and that's our opening session. And we hope to really kind of paint a picture of what the day looks like through that conversation, and really allowing the audience to hear about some of the great things that happen here in the Bay Area. You know, the Bay Area has always been a leader about doing great work and kind of creating change. The free speech movement, the Black Panther Party, we've always been on the forefront. And so now it's time again to really think about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Are there any aspects of this 2013 African American Organizations Making Connections, and the theme is Strategies and Outcomes for Our Black Community? Are there any aspects that you are really vested in, insofar as that you were the one that made sure this was in place this year? Because you've been with Supervisor Keith Carson's office for 10 years, so a very long time.
Yeah, so I worked really closely with the supervisor. He and I kind of put our brain together with some of our other key staff, and we really kind of went through a process, and we just kind of weighed in on what do we want to see.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really talking about what do we want for outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
And so we figured out, you know, how do we create something that actually lives beyond just that Saturday moment? That people could actually take what they learned, the information that they are getting out of those sessions, and take it on and use it and help them to build upon that, organize around it, and create change. And so that was really the intent. So Supervisor Carson and I really thought about that and just thought about the topics, because people want jobs. So why don't we bring experts and business owners to talk about their successes? And it's always great to have testimony from individuals who are actually in it and doing it, and not theorizing, but actually are doing it and have success in it.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
So then we have, like, the police chief talking about public safety, but we also have community-based organizations paired on that panel as well to talk about some of the successes and some of the ideas they use
mm-hmm.
to prevent violence and uplift the community and create safer communities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember last time, besides, you know, the workshops, which I'm not certain if there are any addition, once you've got our community a safe place, public safety, business, job creation, which you already mentioned, workforce development strategies, Black health and wellness, a Black community as one, intergenerational relationships, you've got faith-based and community-based organizations, and you've got Black men, Black women, how do we strengthen our communication? I remember last time that you also had Dr. Wade Nobles. He
mm-hmm.
gave a really wonderful,
mm-hmm.
it was, I think it was around lunchtime, and he gave that presentation that he's so good at, and I think, you know, maybe this is work that, you know, he is most well known for, is the whole idea of how does one claim and I guess nurture one's humanity. How does one become human and stay human? And he talks about that from, you know, a comedic and African sensibility. And I know he's speaking again, because I remember seeing it on another flyer, but I don't see him in what you just sent me. So
we, you know, his schedule didn't permit for him to be a participant.
Oh, he's not a part of it this time.
No,
he
was number one on the list.
Yeah.
But his schedule didn't allow for him to actually be part of it, because, I mean, he actually, like you said, his last presentation and dialogue was really, it just had people at the edge of their chairs. You know,
mm-hmm.
people just wanted more.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought, that that was a way to kind of bring people forward and kind of continue this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was one of the original ways that we were kind of planning around this event, was to have him be a part of this effort.
Mm-hmm.
But definitely as we continue, because this is not just a one-day event.
Mm-hmm.
This is like a movement. This is like a call to action. And so with that said, we really need to be thinking about what happens beyond Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
What's the next steps? How are we going to help people to build businesses, to create jobs? How are we going to create better, more healthy habits within our community?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and how are we going to just be stronger in general, you know, and leverage? Because, I mean, it's just the things that are impacting our community as far as health and crime and just unemployment statistics.
Mm-hmm.
It's just off the charts, and we need to be really on a daily basis really thinking about how can we do better, and how do we not just point the finger and blame, but really figure out a way to really think better, do better, and just really empower people to want to have
mm-hmm.
to be in a better space.
Yeah. So are you going to have a plenary around the same, the lunch hour or something, and who's going to deliver that?
We're not going to have a plenary around the lunch hour. The lunch hour is going to be kind of a free opportunity, but when we come back together at the end
mm-hmm.
for closing remarks, we're going to kind of give some direction and the next steps.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the outcomes is that we're going to really develop this website
so
people can kind of begin to blog and comment about
mm-hmm.
ideas and suggestions.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to continue that conversation. And then from there, we're going to convene back some working groups.
Mm-hmm.
And really figure out what the next steps are. And so is it that we have more smaller working groups going back out on the different